In the final, the sixth session, where we've been looking at the fundamentals of the Islam belief, and I've been chatting with Akhtar Zaman, the president of the Islamic Center in St. Albans, we've covered the pillars of Islam, and we've had a basis to this. And what Akhtar suggested that we might talk about is the area of human rights, because it's an issue that would often raise its head when we think about Islam in the modern world. Why did you think that human rights are something we should be raising as an issue?
It's a very important aspect of Islam that seems to get overlooked. It's actually enshrined in the basic belief, and it's written in the Quran. So this is God's law. We as Muslims believe this is God's law, and He has told us what human rights are and how we are to behave. Sometimes we kind of look at what's going on around the world today and we get a completely different picture to what reality is. Some of the things we hear about, they're not necessarily a view of Islam. This is something that individuals or groups have carried out, and of course they are always then seen as Muslims carrying that out, which means that it must be Islam which is telling them to do that. In fact, you know, sanctity of life, respect for others, children, adults, women, you know, this is all very clearly defined within the Quran as to how, you know, you must behave with each of these types of humans or individuals.
Fighting through the misunderstandings which one senses that we get from the quick and easy media coverage, as it were, there's often been the line that the Quran and that Islam says if you kill one man, you kill humanity.
Correct.
And that seems to be completely contrary to the impression we often have of Islam.
Absolutely. You know, there are times when, if I could use this word loosely, it's permitted, because if somebody is about to kill you and you defend yourself, then you can be forgiven for that. But to go out with a calm mind and say, I'm going to just kill somebody or detonate a bomb as a suicide bomber, that is prohibited. You've mentioned yourself, to kill somebody is the equivalent of killing all of mankind. Mm. And that's in the Quran. Yet all we hear about these days is, oh, well, you know, as a Muslim, you're going to detonate a bomb and just kill people for the sake of it. No.
When we were talking about Hajj, you referred to the sins and the cleansing of the sins, getting closer to God to understand where you've been going wrong and how you can correct that. And it seemed to me perfectly logical in Islam, as in other religions, that people get it wrong. They may state a belief, they may hold to a belief, they may have been brought up in a belief, but they don't always get it right. So why shouldn't we look at the certain aspects of what some Muslims do, both in this country and the world in general, and say, well, that's not because they're Muslims. That's because they've got it wrong.
That's correct. And, you know, one of the other things that we need to be very clear about is the fact that just because they're Muslims and they carry out an act doesn't mean they're doing it because they're Muslim. They're doing it because they want to do it.
Yeah. They're a man, or they're a criminal, or they're a bully, or like every other human being.
And again, without getting too political, we hear about some of the atrocities which have happened in Belgium and France recently. And, you know, it's like, oh, the Muslims are doing this, they've come in. These people who carried out these atrocities were actually living in that country. They were known to the authorities to be of a particular type of person.
Let's look at the different aspects of human rights, because within the context, you've often said during our conversations, God tells us to do this. So you accept, if I may put it crudely, that God has rights.
Yes. Yes.
That's one side of the coin.
Absolutely.
But what you're saying is there are human rights on the other side, not against God, but within God's understanding.
Correct. Correct. There are certain rights that God has, and He's very clearly defined them and what we as believers have to do. And then, of course, He's also taught us how to lead a good life and interact with other human beings or mankind, whether it's your parents, whether it's your neighbors, whether it's your children, whether it's somebody elderly who lives nearby, whether it's an orphan. So each of these has a prescribed way of interacting with them. And it all boils down to kindness, generosity, respect, and making life easier for these people.
So you would have respect for the older people because of, by virtue of the fact that they are your parents or whatever.
Yes.
In Judaism, the mother is a very important root of continuity, as it were. What's in Islam?
Each of them has their own rights, but the mother, if I could take you back to a story that was narrated when a person went to ask the Prophet, what rights do my parents have over me and who has the most right? And the first response was your mother. So the question was asked again. And after that, the second response was your mother. The question was asked. So after that, the third response was your mother. The fourth time was your father. So according to the scriptures and the traditions of the Prophet, the mother has three times as many rights as your father. One, she went through labor and pain to give you birth. She nurtured you, helped you grow up. When you fell down, she was there for you. She fed you, etc. So a mother has many, many rights that need to be respected compared to the father. Of course, your father is an important figure in your life. However, it is stated that the path to paradise is within the footsteps of your mother.
And yet often we get the impression that the woman is, in some Islamic communities, is a second-rate person, and this doesn't seem to tie in.
It's an unfortunate, I would like to say, misnomer, but in some cultures it's a reality. But not because of Islam. That's more of a cultural thing. Islam has actually given quite a respected place to a woman. You know, some of the most important figures within Islam were women, and they had certain rights, and people respected that.
I have to say, I didn't know that. I had no impression. Yeah. I have an impression of Islam as being male-dominated from top to bottom, as it were. What is the role of these women?
If you go back over all the religious scriptures, then they were male-dominated. However, behind every male were the female figures. The two prominent ones that we've already mentioned, Mary, I mean, she's a very prominent figure within Islam. I'd say that even higher than in Christianity. I'm sure a lot of people would disagree with me on that, but because a whole chapter of the Quran is given to her and what she went through. Similarly, you know, I've mentioned Hagar, the wife of Abraham, and then there were the wives of the Prophet and other similar prominent figures who came along. But because a lot of the Islamic world comes from a male-dominated culture, a lot of people seem to think that, you know, women don't have rights. They have rights. In fact, Islam gave more rights to women 1400 years ago than they have in the Western world today. But a lot of people don't know that.
We've talked about sanctity of life, we've talked about the role of the woman, albeit briefly. Mm. What about workers' rights and slavery?
Slavery is a fact that's happened. No one can say that's happened due to religion. It's just something that culturally used to happen. And Saudi Arabia as it is today, or Arabia as it was at the time, was no different. Slaves were taken from Africa and made to do the work. However, at the time of the Prophet, when Islam started to take hold, there were certain rights given to the slaves. And where possible, the Prophet asked their masters to free them. And those who accepted Islam did that freely. Some actually went as far as to purchase slaves from others so they could free them and get the closeness or nearness of their creator that way as well. One of the closest companions of the Prophet was Bilal, who was of Abyssinian or African descent. He was a black male who used to have a lisp when he spoke as well. And of course, there were other prominent people from the Quraysh tribe, which was the tribe of the Prophet, who thought that they should have a better position than him. But no, the Prophet chose him. You hear about the five times call to prayer. When this happened at the time of the Prophet, he asked Bilal to perform that duty, which was such an important duty. So Bilal, who was black, was treated equally. He was freed from being a slave because his master, when he found out he'd accepted Islam, tried to punish him through torture and so on. But Bilal stood fast and said, no, there is only one God. Mm. And when the companions of the Prophet saw this, they spoke to him about it and they were able to buy him and free him. And he became a very prominent figure within Islam.
It's quite interesting because it's a quite interesting symbol, because not only is he a black African, a slave, but he has a speech impediment.
Exactly.
He's bringing everything together and talking about the value of the worth of an individual.
Absolutely. And that's a perfect summary. I think you've summarized it better than I could there, Rob.
Yeah. What about modern day slaves is now theoretically history, but not in fact, but almost. Workers' rights are often an issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's written in the Quran very clearly that if you ask somebody to do some work for you, make sure you pay them what they merit as a wage and do not delay it in any way. If they've done a good day's work for you, then pay them for that day. If they've done it for a week, pay them for the week, and as quickly as possible, because clearly they're doing it to earn a living, and by you delaying it could cause them harm.
Did you see that in Islam it in any way changes? I mean, if you're an employer of lots of people working for you, does it change that you have obligations as an employer, not just in the paying for the work, but in the way you treat those
Absolutely.
Workers?
Absolutely. You know, you've got to treat them so that they are not in danger. They're able to carry out the duties that you're asking them to do.
Sort of health and safety.
Health and safety, absolutely. So in modern day terminology, that's exactly what it is. There are many stories where something like this happened, where somebody came and did some work, but they'd left before they were paid for it. However, that person who asked them to carry out the work kept that money, invested it as it grew, whatever it grew to. When he met them afterwards, he gave them the whole lot, saying, this is yours. They said, well, no, I only did half a day's work for you. How can this? No, I invested it on your behalf. This is what it's become now. So this is all yours.
One of the things we often hear is that if you're a Muslim, you can't invest and in certain ways, and you can't make a profit on it. I'm a little bit confused now, because that story suggests you can invest.
Yes, I mean, investment is not prohibited in any way whatsoever. What's prohibited in Islam is to earn money from others where it's known as interest. Interest is prohibited in Islam, giving and taking of interest on money. But if you were to invest it in some way, for instance, let's take it back to the times of the Prophet. For instance, if you were able to buy two camels, which was commodity at the time, and of course they had further camels from that and that grew, then of course your investment is growing. What the Islamic banks do these days is, for instance, you know, people need to borrow money. Mm. But what they don't say is, I want to borrow £1,000 and the interest rate will be 3%, so therefore I'm going to pay back this amount. No, it doesn't work like that, because then interest comes into interest is prohibited.
Okay.
What they tend to do is say, okay, I will buy whatever it is for you, but then I'm going to sell it to you. So I'm going to buy it for £1,000. I'm going to sell it to you for £1,100. So you have to pay me £1100. So that's how you get around.
And is that part of Sharia?
It is.
Banking Sharia law?
You've touched on a point where it's a bad word in the Western world, Sharia law. But if you were to actually look at the actual laws, I mean, what it is, it's based on Quranic teaching supplemented by needs of the day without going against the original Quranic law. So that's what Sharia law is. So it's supposed to be to help everybody, bring a lot more justice, equality, etc. However, a lot of people seem to associate Sharia law with chopping people's heads off. No, that's not what it's about.
Okay. Well, I think one would have to explore all the aspects. Yeah. How would one do that? Is the Sharia law so literally based upon the holy book, the holy books, that it's all there? Or is that where it's derived?
Most of it is there, because the holy book does cover a lot of law. So we talk about the rights of people, we cover about lending of money, about interest and how you should not give or take interest, if it's at all possible. It's how you treat other people, how you treat guests. It's all in there. However, you know, it's not going to have every single scenario that you can come across. So what you can do is say, okay, well, based on that, we're not contravening any of that, but we need additional. For instance, the example I give is, it's not going to tell you what time you have to switch off your street lights. It just won't. Right. However, based on the teachings, what you've got to think about is, well, if I switch them off too early, is it going to hamper the people? If I leave them on too long, is it going to waste money that belongs to the public? This is the thought process you go through, which links it to the Sharia law.
So does a Muslim, in a mixed community like ours, where you have all faiths and none, as it were, does a Muslim find it easy to work within the broader community? I mean, you yourself are a professional, you work, you have a business that that is involved in information technology or whatever. Is it easy for a Muslim to be just like any other person in the context of the bigger community?
There are certain things where it's difficult. And I remember when I first got introduced to this community, etc., it was different because I found it that so there were certain things which were different. However, having lived here and gone through, if I could say, certain pains, I'm actually a better person for it, with a better understanding of why certain things happen and how they relate back to my faith as well.
Okay. So being a Muslim, you don't feel excluded?
No.
You feel you can bring your judgment to your situation?
Correct, okay. Yeah. I'm quite a vocal person. Although people used to say I was an introvert, somehow I've become a bit more of a vocal person now. I like to actually debate and discuss these things with people. You know, why does certain thing happen in a certain way? And normally I believe that history and religion normally provides an answer as to why certain things happen in a certain way.
Thank you. We're going to go into our discussion now. Then our next session will be with the other two gentlemen, Canon Tony Hill and Rabbi Rafi, and we'll bring together some of the issues that we've raised with each of you, and look forward to those discussions.
I look forward to it too, Rob.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.